Hello and welcome to Express Yourself, the UCC Express podcast. On today's episode, we have opinion editor Benin Talpur, aka myself, and Luca Cavallo, our arts and lit editor. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about the relationship between arts and STEM. Benin has a background in science education, whereas Luca has an English background. So we feel that we are suited to talk about this, guys. More often than not, the relationship between arts and STEM is often a conflicting one, where there's intense competition between the two and a huge rivalry, arts versus STEM. But on today's episode, we're taking a different take. Today, we're going to be talking about the positives and how both fields can actually complement each other in order to make the world a better place. Both of us have written articles on the relationship between arts and STEM, and today we just thought that we'd talk a bit more about it in depth. The topics that we're going to be going through today are the digital media, technology, AI, and how arts and STEM work, using science to preserve art, elitism, jobs, and funding, the stigma or stereotype of being an arts or a STEM student, how inventions have been inspired both in the arts world and in the STEM world for warfare and from the space race as inspirations, and finally, the importance of curiosity and how both fields require you to be curious in order to create great work. Right, Luca. So starting off with us today on a podcast using technology to talk about arts and STEM, we'll be going through how we're in the digital age. So any thoughts?
That's right. We are in the digital age. It's actually, you know, kind of a good thing because we have arts and STEM. They've never been closer, have they? And you're saying, yeah, you're right. We are on a podcast right now speaking to microphones, and it makes it for a new medium, a new way of communicating and a new way of expressing things. We have all of the different radio shows and all the recordings and everything like that. And it all comes down to science, and it can be a new way of expressing art. So the digital age it's very new. It's kind of like something we've had, you know, kind of late 80s into the 90s. And I think a good way to start with it and where it all started is looking at like a digital camera. So you would have this kind of like way of taking photos that was new and different. It wasn't relying on film anymore, it wasn't analog, it was digital. And it kind of rose questions about how we can actually preserve art, how we can have it in like a digital sphere, you know, not just like something that will that could like be destroyed or be lost. The medium is kind of indestructible in a way. I mean, at the same time though, it's not palpable. It's not like right in front of you. It's like on a screen. It's digitally passed throughout the world. So it's kind of a give and take, you know. But, you know, there's great ways to look at it. Like you have kind of digital renderings of like old English manuscripts or something. And you can use that new technology to preserve and even like enhance those images. I remember actually when I was about 15, when I was in TY, I was working just for, you know, the odd Friday here and there for work experience in the museum in Fitzgerald's Park. Have you ever been there?
Yes, I have. Yes. Great museum.
I was working in the back, and they had like all these really, really old letters written by certain Irish figures from history. I think Michael Collins is one of them actually. And we would be taking like scans of them. We'd be trying to decipher the writing, and there was like a whole afternoon spent over like this one word at the end of a sentence that no one could tell what it was, because it was just very poor handwriting, you know. And they were turning up the brightness, turning up the contrast, trying to look at it in different ways, scan through it using technology to find out what the word was. And I don't know if they actually figured out what it was, and maybe they did, but unfortunately I've forgotten. It was some 6 years ago now, which is crazy. But it was very interesting to see pieces of, you know, a literary text if you want to call it that, being deciphered through the eyes of digital media and digital technology, which is very interesting in what we have about like media that can be preserved and won't be lost.
Speaking of, you also wanted to talk about lost music and yes. music being preserved and how there's so yeah. much range in music nowadays.
We have we've like kind of a small, really small kind of like internet subgenre of music called like lost media. So they'll have like snippets of songs from like the 80s, and they were like recorded off the radio one day by someone with like a little tape recorder, but they don't know what it's called. They don't know who wrote it, who performs it, what year it's from. And they'll kind of put it out on the internet and be like, does anyone know this? And no one knows what it is. It's like, there's a song that like is kind of, it's kind of titled Everyone Knows That, but that's not the name of the song. It's just like a kind of a lyric in the song, and it's not even the full song. It's about 19 seconds. So it's really interesting to see how, yes, we can preserve media, but at the same time, we don't really have all the information that we could need. It's kind of like maybe we're too reliant on us, on everything to be preserved. There's like no one's actually counting, maybe. And we get those kind of little secrets and kind of unknown entities of the internet. And it's like, where did this come from? I don't know. You know?
Yeah. I do love finding a song on Shazam, though. Shazam is great for finding a song that you don't know, sounds like an absolute bop, and you can just press that button. I will always appreciate Shazam. And then I have it. Shazam, the latest song really, that I'm really going to play on repeat again and again.
It's like, I'm not so sure now because, you know, I'm the art speaker, so I don't really know my stem that well, but I'm fairly certain that Shazam will rely on a kind of an AI to determine the music that's being played. It's like it can like immediately capture what you're playing and it will put it into something. And it is like based off of what's in like the digital art archive. So, you know, if you were going to play like Everyone Knows That, then it wouldn't actually be able to tell you what it is, which is kind of sad. But it's like
very sad.
It's not like a, you know, like a magic thing of like someone just figuring it out and saying, oh yeah, it's this, it's like it's everything. And it kind of goes to show for like what AI stands for, which is just like a listening and repeating, kind of like taking it in and saying, oh, this is what I interpret this as. But Shazam is really good for that. And AI is bigger than ever now, and Shazam is like just like a tiny piece that no one even thinks about it anymore, do they?
Yeah, no, AI is huge, and there are both advantages and disadvantages to AI. AI is changing the world at a faster pace than ever before. We're trying to figure out how fast it can go. Can it replicate the human and the work that a human does? All these questions are now being posed as a result of this technological STEM invention. And I believe that AI can be very helpful. I don't want it to replace any of us, though, but I do think it's a great source for inspiration.
I think AI, you know, talking in our kind of general theme of like arts and STEM can go hand in hand. There's a very interesting thing to be said about like art through AI and kind of like a hand in hand way of going about it. Like, of course, there is that fear of AI taking over, and like we had the writer's strike last year, and some of those silly producers saying, oh, we can just get AI to write for us. You know, they obviously had no idea what they were talking about, because you do need your originality, and if AI is just based off of like prior knowledge, then it's just not going to know. It can be influenced by other things, but it won't be able to produce anything originally, you know?
Yeah, because currently most of the way that it works is that there's this neural network, you feed in a bunch of data and it manipulates that data to come up with new answers.
Yeah, I think it can be really helpful for kind of giving you a bit of inspiration, you know, kind of relying on AI to just kind of give you a little bit of a point in the right direction, because you can give it like a prompt and say like, oh, I want something a little bit like this. And then the AI might give you, if it's like an image generator or something, it might give you something along those lines. And then you might say, oh, I like that, or oh, I didn't like that. And then you can go off of that and make your own thing. So I think it is an interesting device to use for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, AI would be great for inspiration. Not copying, but as inspo, I do think AI is something that works really well.
Yes, it's still like a really, you know, a threatening thing, because AI, unfortunately, is still evolving. And that kind of, you know, lack of originality in AI, it could be gone. It could be AI could become original and its own kind of creator in the future. We don't really know. I certainly don't know. I wouldn't really have the scientific knowledge on that. But it does seem like something that could happen in the future. I mean, obviously, you know, when people think about, like, you know, AI takeover, it's kind of like a Terminator thing with like Skynet and the robots, but it's probably not that at all. But if they were to kind of create like a new machine that was like able to just learn and like from that learning create original and new things, then I think we would be in trouble. There was someone said, and I don't remember who it was, unfortunately, said that when AI makes art, we're all doomed. Luckily, can we say that AI makes art yet?
I don't think we're at this stage yet.
No.
But it might happen in the future. It's getting more and more powerful every day. And that's just life.
The growth is very, very fast. It's shot up since like early days of programming back in like the 50s. It's, if you think about it, like in a big picture view, it's very, very fast approaching. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that. Yeah, maybe another episode of this. I'm talking about, you know, oh no, the AI has taken over everything and they've taken over us. Yeah, this could be the calm before the storm, Vinny.
Yeah, we'll try to not go into the doom and gloom here.
Hopefully not.
No. Yeah, but speaking of AI and digital media, thinking about how there's so much media out there these days now. We're spoiled for choice.
It is the choice, isn't it? Like, we've always had so much to choose from, but it's like right in our face now.
Like on Netflix, what do I watch? And with ads, so many ads on YouTube, the ads are just kind of, they're going too far nowadays.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, when you were watching TV, you obviously had like fewer channels, and it was like you didn't have like that absolute choice of whatever you wanted, because it was dependent more on schedules and stuff, and everything was kind of, you know, live playing all the time, and there would be the ads, and they would come like, you know, at a kind of like it was kind of expected, you know, you'd like, oh, I have to get up and get a glass of water anyway. The ads are on. It's okay. And it's like, and then your sister calls from downstairs, like, it's back on. And then you go and you continue the show. It wasn't really that much of a nuisance as much. But now, like, in our own time, and it's like, we have that kind of like instant gratification. It's like, I need everything now, and I have to have as much as I need. Ads are like, it's like we have less patience for them. It's like, what purpose do they serve us at all? You know?
Yeah. And since it's a service that we're paying for, ideally I don't want to be seeing ads. Yeah. So, I mean, it poses this question about quality and the commodification of art, basically. Like, should we pay for it? Should we not? And since there's so much out there,
it's harder to say about commodifying art, because if you're talking in a sense of like streaming platforms and stuff, you've got art that is taken more as entertainment than kind of something of like artistic value. And I don't mean that in a way of like an avant-garde thing. It's like just a basic kind of artistic approach to things. It's things that are, you know, kind of generalized into a more kind of like fun and entertaining environment, which I actually really do enjoy a lot. I think it's fantastic. But when you have like all these shows and movies on Netflix like at your fingertips, and it's like a huge collage of posters and actors' faces, and it's like you get to make the choice, it makes it so hard to choose as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one good way in which technology and the media work well together is animation, though, because you're using so much physics, so much animation software, technology in order to create something. I think animation is something that captures human emotion in the best way out of all the digital media that is out there. I do think that animation is a whole other ballgame. You could watch an animated movie at any age, and I still think that they just work the best in capturing the emotions. And I guess some of it is the effort on the artists, the technologists, the computer scientists that create that kind of technology. And it helps to make something that has such high artistic value, like the product is worth so much more.
That is so true. Yeah, I think that animation, animated movies, animated TV shows, they are a wonderful joining of arts and STEM, because it's like you have that kind of, you have your art and your artwork, and you want to like bring it to life on the big screen. And to do that, it takes a lot of science and computing, and yeah, there's a lot of work in it. Like, it's kind of an age-old joke now. It's like, you know, artists would love to be animators. A lot of artists want to be animators, but they haven't got like the work ethic for it. It's like, it's actually some of the hardest work you've to do, because you've got to do like frame by frame and make sure everything is rendering nicely. And there's so much, like, there's so much science behind it. And it's not so much about like making your beautiful shots. It's like actually making them work, you know, which is really interesting. I think that I have there's a lot of respect for animators as artists nowadays. You have like, you know, there's huge money in anime. And I know there's like MAPPA Studios. They're making a lot of the top anime right now. They've just made second season of Jujutsu Kaisen, and they finished up Attack on Titan. And what else do they do? I can't really recall. But they've done loads of shows. And there's kind of a you know, a joke that they're all extremely overworked. But that's kind of more going by the Japanese ethics of
their work culture. Hours. Yeah,
their work culture is very, very big. But they put countless hours into their work, which is so admirable.
Moving on to digital art versus physical art. And I always think that art is often inspired by science, and not just on the technology side, but often so by nature and what the artist sees around them. And I think both kind of play around with each other, like science fiction with all these predictions on what the future will look like, versus art being inspired by nature through paintings such as Van Gogh's paintings, always being inspired by the sky, nature, flowers, the natural world is often a huge thing in both physical art, or when it comes to poetry, like for example, William Butler Yeats for Lake Isle of Innisfree, like this idea of a utopia, this perfect natural world.
Yes, art is inspired by nature very dominantly. But we actually, it's very interesting, in the past like 100 years, we've had a lot of art that's inspired, maybe not as positively as something like the Lake Isle of Innisfree, but inspired by technology and like kind of as a response to our time. To like our social changes, because technology obviously it changes society, it changes things up. So, you know, if you go back to the early 1900s, you have like Italian futurism, and that was like an artistic movement that was very much inspired by like the car and like the photograph and the gramophone, and they were kind of trying to make like poetry and paintings that could kind of replicate the effect of these technology. Like they were trying to capture motion, and they were trying to make these like sound poems. So one guy, Marinetti, he made this sound poem called Zang Tum Tum. And it's like kind of trying to make a battlefield on a page, and it's a lot of like onomatopoeia and like strange typography. The movement was it wasn't very popular at the time, but I think it's still important to have these artists to look back to, and how they were responding way before something like the digital age or AI was something that we talked about, and they were still creating their art in response to changes in society and to modernity. There is obviously a kind of an elephant in the room about science inspiring art and stories, and it's science fiction. You know, there's kind of ideas of like soft science fiction and hard science fiction, and I think that something that people don't really talk about a lot is how Star Wars, probably one of the most popular science fiction stories out there, besides maybe Star Trek or something, isn't science fiction at all. It's actually fantasy, because there's magic. Because think about it, because he moves stuff with no explanation for anything. It's magic. So you go. It's kind of like a wrong stigma about it, about, you know, science being having like a role in science fiction. I don't, when I'm talking about like science and technology inspiring art, I usually don't really turn to science fiction as much, because it's kind of more of like a fantastical approach to it, you know, like starships and wormholes and stuff, which is, you know, is very cool, definitely very cool, but not so much along the same lines as like a real inspiration from like our actual modern context of science and technology. And, you know, obviously you have your science fiction fans, and that kind of like creates the stereotype that science fiction fans are fans of science and they're all science students, which isn't really the case, is it?
No, not really. I'm not a big science fiction girl at all. I do think some of it is just, it just goes too far, and I don't really like it. But in terms of the media, then I think the representation of scientists has always been shocking, almost really bad representation. It's almost, it always, like in the case of the Big Bang Theory, that it's people who have this special niche interest in science. And they have so much knowledge, they think they're better than everyone else, leading to this idea of elitism. But they know so much about something so specific, and some of them can come off as obnoxious or rude. And it's never in a way that's accessible for the average person. Like, or even these characters, they're always on their own. And sometimes the scientist is never seen as a cool person for all their knowledge. They're just seen as, oh, the guy who just loves atomic physics or whatever.
Is it kind of done in a way where it's like the scientist character is posed as someone who you, like, you know, the ordinary person could never be?
Oh, yeah.
Because this person is like an outsider. And they're in their own field, and that's where they're going to stay. And it's like their whole personality, is that it?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think some of it is that, and just thinking again that they're better than everybody else.
Yeah, there's a lot of obnoxious science characters, actually. Yeah, even like adaptations of science, like real science characters. Science characters? Scientists.
Scientists, yes.
Like we have Alan Turing, played by Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game. He was kind of like his character was treated as someone who just kind of knew that he was smarter than everyone else in the room. And yeah, he kind of was, but he really enjoyed that fact, which isn't really fair to portraying Alan Turing as like a real person. Of course, we can't really know what he really was, because we're all kind of, it's all kind of shadowed by Benedict Cumberbatch now, but there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that there are good examples. For example, Oppenheimer was done very well in that he was portrayed as a great character. And yes, he had this invention, this really good idea, how he was working, and this portrayal of science throughout. And then addressing that conflict of when science does go wrong, like, should he have built the atomic bomb at all? I guess, regardless,
I think that's an easy no.
Easy no, yes. But yeah, we are, as Cillian Murphy himself says in Oppenheimer's world, the bomb is made and it has done its damage. And I mean, hopefully there won't be another war, but...
Oh, don't say that. Yeah. No, Oppenheimer was definitely a shining beacon in terms of representing scientists. It was, you know, he was a real person.
It absolutely, was great. Yeah.
And I'm so glad that Cillian Murphy has gotten the Oscar for it.
Absolutely. Same here. And Hidden Figures, portraying black female scientists and work that nobody knew about, finally came to the forefront, and women's contribution to the space race through that film, and presenting again their challenges, the science, the facts that they were dealing with at the time in order to get the first man on the moon. Again, that's an example of a good representation of science. And in a world where often the representation of a scientist is a white middle-class male, seeing women being represented and being shown on screen in a scientific context can be really inspirational for future female scientists.
Yeah, it's really important for kind of, you know, giving you the role models and stuff. And I actually admit that I actually haven't heard of that movie of Hidden Figures. I knew of those women, but I didn't even know there was a movie about them. So what does that say about kind of media representing them properly and getting the messages out there, you know?
I think across the board, we do need more representation of women in STEM.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Definitely. And we absolutely will, hopefully, in the future with, you know, rising numbers of women in STEM.
Absolutely.
Like, if you look at third level education, you have all your CAO points, and there's kind of like a cutoff point around accountancy. And then from there, the percentages of women in courses, and a lot of these are STEM courses, a lot of the percentages are women. There's obviously, you know, kind of going by general stereotypes, but it is quite true. There's quite a few minorities of women in courses like engineering.
Yeah.
But in the other ST and M, there's mainly women. It's fantastic to see in the last few years.
Yeah, no, I think there is more women in biological fields. In chemistry, it's kind of going up, but that gap is still very prevalent in maths and physics and engineering fields. So hopefully with more representation, things will get better.
Yeah. Of course, you go.
But the elitism issue is right across the board. At third level, it's really hard to not see elitism, especially I think in the science field. I think science is so inaccessible. It's so hard to find if you don't study STEM at third level and beyond. Chances are after the junior cert even, maybe the leaving cert, you're never going to come across much science again in your life. I think with arts, it's much easier because you will always have access to a bookshop. You will always have access to the digital media in the age that we are now.
All your streaming platforms, yeah.
But for science, where do you even go? Like, the language used in science magazines and literary journals is often so complex. I know peer review has its value and it should be there, but sometimes the only way to access science is looking at papers online and to go through a paywall, which most people don't want to do. And a lot of these papers are just too expensive. So the average person, I believe, loses their access to science as they get older. And again, that loses the issue. That comes back to the issue again of the lack of representation. And I don't think it's necessarily a lack of interest. I do think it is an elitism problem. Again, coming back to that obnoxious, rude person, or the idea of what a scientist should be, that everyday access to science, I feel, is gone or less as you get older.
I think it is true that science is treated as something that can't be enjoyed.
Yeah, it's so hard. Like, it's always for an exam, for a job. You can't just like your science anymore.
I know. It's like the people in the world who have the most science knowledge are 8-year-olds and 50-year-old scientists who haven't seen daylight in a week.
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
It really do be like that. Yeah. And then for the 50-year-olds, obviously, there are a load of inventions as a result of that curiosity in terms of both. I think the two big ones would be as a result of wars across the ages and the space race. There's so many inventions that were made, like satellites, GPS, solar panels, as a result of the space race now, because when we went up to space, where would the energy come from except for the sun? Things like memory foam, Skechers shoes. Memory foam what? Came from the space Have race. Yes.
I actually didn't know that.
No, it does. Wow. To make the suits more comfortable and to prevent you from jolting forward when you go up. So memory foam is good for that.
I love memory foam. Thank you. Thank you, Buzz Aldrin. That's great.
And then for warfare, like back to Alan Turing and the Turing test, the code was so important.
We wouldn't have computers if it wasn't for Enigma, you know?
If it wasn't for war, we wouldn't have things like penicillin, which was there before, but mass production only started once World War II came in.
That's true.
And things like the flu vaccine. And again, these inventions, as we know, the majority of them come from that white middle class male funding. And
that is true.
The competition for anybody else is just out of question, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking into speakers right now, and that was all invented for warfare.
Yeah.
And now here we are talking about arts and STEM in UCC. It's kind of interesting how it all kind of just changes. It just comes around. We don't need these things for the reasons that they were made for, which is kind of strange, you know? It is really strange.
It is a weird one, but we do have the inventions now, so I'm glad for that. But again, this representation, the issue, I think there is a huge issue with elitism again, because the funding, the access, the resources.
Funding's a big one. Yeah. I suppose it's just like there's a lot of a lot more money poured into STEM. And there's kind of like the belief that like, oh, more money means more favor for STEM over arts. A lot of the times though, it can just be like an arts project or like a PhD funding thing. It won't actually need as much money. It's not as costly to get the research done. For STEM, it does sometimes require more, you know, which is kind of understandable. So it kind of like, it creates that stereotype then that like, oh, you know, colleges don't put any money into the humanities, but actually they do. They do have a lot of time for it. It is true. And they do are like, you know, they have like that kind of, the kind of equal value, like realistically, but then that doesn't stop the sense of elitism, does it?
No, it doesn't. No. I feel like with an English degree, an English PhD, an English master's, there's always the joke that I have all these qualifications and I'm going to be a barista, versus in a STEM context, you're looking for a job in big pharma or in engineering or in a big company in the Irish context anyways. It's never really research that's for yourself. I feel like these days it's hard to get funding when it's something that you just want to research for the sake of researching, or you just want to write that humanities piece or that PhD.
As an art student, I wouldn't even say that, you know, your research is done just for you. Like, you have to kind of imagine it as like a very, very broad kind of canon of things like literary research or something that I would be interested in, to be honest. And it's like it all kind of plays its part in this big thing, and it all is really, really important for the humanities as a whole. It's not so much like just like a personal project. I mean, you know, there is that personal side to it. Of course, you get, you know, a little bit of freedom about what you want to study, but at the same time, you are contributing to something that isn't, you know, it isn't going to make the trains run faster, and it isn't going to make your car use less petrol, but it is important in a different way, in more of a kind of a humanitarian way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, you know, STEM students, they love to hear that, because they're like, oh, that's nothing compared to my rocket fuel, you know? But I still see the importance in it. I remember in second year, I went to a debate held by the Philosophy Society, and I wasn't debating myself. I was just watching. I was sitting in, and it was on an arts versus STEM debate, quite unlike what we were doing with like an arts with STEM.
Yeah.
And there was some students who were saying, like, you know, oh, like, you know, when you're an art student and, you know, you're just going to end up working at McDonald's and you can't even count up the sum of someone's order because you don't never did maths. And they were making it sound like art students were like kind of just without qualification of any sort, which is kind of a major example of supreme elitism.
So bad.
Yeah. And I found a lot of the art students that were arguing, they were either kind of humorous about it, or they were, you know, not really taking that stance of, like, you know, attacking the STEM students, you know.
And it is a field of immense research. Like, so many skills are transferable between both fields. Like, having the interest, first of all, the commitment, the time it takes to conduct a research, to write that dissertation, to do that PhD is huge. The amount of reading you have to do, looking at prior knowledge and trying to build on that, coming up with your own conclusion, all of these are also scientific concepts. When you're writing a scientific paper or you're looking to publish that journal article, so many skills can be transferred from the humanities. But so many people don't see it as that. They see it as two completely separate things. And I do think that both in arts and in STEM, it all goes back to curiosity. And both are interested in their fields of research. Both should be valued equally. And that research, those skills, that knowledge, ultimately all of it benefits us. Like, in a science perspective, so much of it, again, is now the idea of commodification, making an invention to improve something else. Or you have that specialized knowledge that nobody else can seem to access. And I feel like, again, it goes back to the 8-year-old. Only, I feel like, when you're a kid can you have the knack for just enjoying science, for being curious about it, for having that sense of wonder and looking at the stars, space, dinosaurs, rocks. They're interesting when you're a kid, but as an adult, even if you want to be interested in it, you can't find anything that's there for the pure enjoyment and knowledge side. It's always in terms of, oh, what will this get me in the end?
Maybe that's one of the reasons why humanities in a very kind of STEM-based world that we're living in right now is kind of, it's losing its value a bit. People don't really see the point in it anymore. That said, it's now more than ever so important to appreciate the arts and STEM together.
Absolutely.
As like something that can complement each other.
Yes, we don't need to be fighting over this, guys.
Absolutely
both
not.
Are
it
good.
It does not have to be a debate, because, you know, we can see now in our modern times that arts is influenced by STEM, and STEM can be influenced by arts as well. They can go together and move towards the future in a positive sense, with things like AI and rapidly changing technologies, the digital age. We can see how they can complement each other. So it would be great if we could all just get along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be friends.
Be friends.
Not be elite. Don't be agnostics, guys.
Yeah.
Don't be a trash cat.